All right, guys, we are in 1 Samuel, and last week I had the first opportunity, I think, ever to teach this out at Arrowhead, and because of us having the sharing night. Anyway, it's all worked out. Anyway, you guys are getting 1 Samuel chapter 11 tonight, if you would please turn there. And it's called Desperate Times, Desperate Measures. In the last study that we had here on 1 Samuel, we saw Saul as the reluctant king. You guys might remember they found him hiding in the equipment. I call it the equipment tent because I'm assuming probably was a tent, but it could have been just an open area. It was where the equipment was stored, and that's pretty much where they found him. And the point that I would like to make just as a refresher to us is that Saul is not overjoyed with the thought of becoming king. He is still adjusting. And I think we can relate to that. Anytime God calls us to a new level of commitment to Him, we're excited about the possibility, but we also know to whom much is given, much is required. So we know that there's another side to this. And Samuel has made no bones about the fact that Israel has appointed him king in disobedience to God. So he's a bit of that reluctant king. We also saw the Lord give Samuel a new heart. And Scripture says that it made him, that God made him into a new man. You might remember we talked about him when he joined the prophets coming down from the mountain there. And I talked to you about, I didn't personally see Saul as the, kumbaya singing kind of guy. That I can see David as that kind of guy, but Saul not necessarily as that kind of guy. But it said that Scripture gave Saul a new heart and made him a new man. So my encouragement in that teaching was for all of us that when God begins to call you in to that new level of commitment to Him, that new sitting a little closer to Him, we have a tendency to say, Lord, I can't do it. I'm not equipped for this. I can't handle it. Moses, I can't speak. You know, there's always some excuse as to why we can't move in. But we need to keep these things in mind, and that is God can give you and I a new heart. We need to be praying, not necessarily, Lord, don't give me this opportunity, but God, equip me for this opportunity. Give me a new heart. Change me. Make me into this new person if you're calling me to this new level. And I know that in my pilgrimage or my journey, as God began to call me into different things, there was always a bit of apprehension on my part. I remember when he called me to be Pastor Bob Claycamp's assisting pastor, it was a bit overwhelming because I had not been in full-time ministry up to this point, and it was a bit intimidating. And one of my primary functions was to counsel, to work with people when they would come in and they were hurting. Because Pastor Bob was, he needed to have the time to pray and study and teach, and so I needed to take some of that load from him. And I remember being overwhelmed because there are a lot of hurting people in this world, amen? There's a lot of folks that you think you got it tough, you know, you're whining and complaining, and then someone comes in and shares their story with you, and they walk out and you're going, oh my goodness. You know, they're really hurting. And sometimes you might deal with that two or three or four times a day. And I remember after a couple weeks, I told my wife, I said, you know, unless God does something, I'm not going to be able to do this. She says, what do you mean? And I said, I just don't know if I can handle it. Because people come in, they share their broken heart with you, and when they leave, you have a broken heart. And you just grieve for them. And then you multiply that times two or three or four times in a given day, and you just, it's overwhelming. And I would find myself sometimes on the way home just weeping and praying for these people. And I told my wife, unless God does something in my heart, I don't think I can do this. I mean, I just don't think I can do this. I'm going to be a wreck. And I prayed and I asked God to do a work in my heart, and He did. He gave me a new heart. And the way He dealt with me on that is He said, John, who do you think you are? He kind of has a way of putting you in your place, doesn't He? And I said, I don't understand what you mean. He goes, well, who do you think you are? You're not me. You can't do anything about this. You can't solve this. You're not the giver and taker of life. This is too big for you. You can't do anything about this. All that you can do is listen and weep with them, with those who weep, and rejoice with those who rejoice. And the greatest thing that you can do is when they walk out of the office, you give them to me. And then I'll take care of them from there. That's the best job that you can do. That's all that you can do. And I thought, I can do that. You know, I can do that. And so God gave me a new heart. God made me a new man. I couldn't do the job. I didn't have what it took to do the job. But God gave me the ability to do the job. And then when we stepped out to do the Bible study down here and to start Calvary Chapel Central Phoenix, I remember being overwhelmed once again and thinking, I can't do this. I don't know how to do this. And over at my other church, I could always say, go see Pastor Bob. It's not my job. You know, I don't know how to do this. And so he's the man. You go see him. If I didn't have an answer, I could say, go see him. Well, all of a sudden now I'm going to be the senior pastor. But I could still say, go to see Jesus. You know, you need to go see him. And God changed my heart, and he equipped me once again. But anytime God calls us to a new level, and please don't make the mistake of thinking that's vertical. Because so many times we think it's a step up. Sometimes it's a step sideways. Sometimes it's a step back. Ultimately, it is a step forward. Because God's working in our heart and our life. But we live in a world where everything's upwardly mobile, and we need to be careful that we don't think in those kind of terms. In fact, I was sharing with a good brother tonight. He tells us those who are the servant of all are of the greatest use in the kingdom. So God is constantly trying to teach us how to have that servant's heart. But any time he calls us into a new work or a new thing, there's going to be a little bit of humbling that takes place. I don't know if we call it fear, but trepidation, maybe, same thing. We're going to be a little hesitant because we realize this is too big for me. I can't do this. Saul is facing the very, very same thing. But God gives him a new heart, and when God guides, he provides. So therefore, if he's calling us, we can do it. We just need to not be afraid. God's not limited. God's not limited. So if you and I will put our faith, you and I will put our faith and trust in him, then he will accomplish that work. Sometimes we just won't let him do it because we freak out. We get scared and we back down. And lastly, we saw at the end of chapter 10 that there were some that were not very happy about Saul becoming king. In fact, if you look at chapter 10, verse 27, it says, "But some rebels said, 'How can this man save us?' So they despised him, and they brought him no presents. But he, Saul, as king, he held his peace." And I shared with you guys that sometimes we have a tendency to think, man, I've been praying and God's opening a door. He's telling me to go through this. And yes, I'm a little fearful, but God's good. Where he guides, he's going to provide. And as I step through this, it's all going to be blessing. Not always. In fact, most often it's not all blessing. Don't get me wrong. There's blessing in it because God's in it and God's calling you to this. But I want you to always have to keep the cross in focus. Jesus was doing his Father's will. But not everybody was willing to accept the Father's will. Not everybody's willing to accept Saul being king. And as I shared with you, even in America, when we vote in a new king, there's a large constituency that doesn't want him to be president. So just because we're doing the Lord's will doesn't mean that everyone is going to see that. Not everyone is going to necessarily agree with that. And we need to know that along with that will come some trials. Now, greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. So we can overcome those things, but if we're going to go the way of the cross, if we're going to follow the example of Jesus, we can expect that not everyone is going to understand. And remember, he had a large crowd when he was an instant welfare program. When he could feed the thousands and he could clothe the thousands and he was taking care of their needs. But when he started pointing to the cross, what started happening to those crowds? They got thinner and thinner and thinner. Look at chapter 11, verses 1 through 3. Then Nahash, the Ammonite, He came up and he camped against Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, make a covenant with us and we will serve you. Verse 2, and Nahash the Ammonite answered them. He said, on this condition I will make a covenant with you, that I may put out all of your right eyes. Now that doesn't mean that one guy had a lot of right eyes. Right? That means all the men in this particular tribe, in this particular section that they were coming up against. That I may put out all of your right eyes and bring reproach upon all of Israel. Then the elders of Jabesh said to him, hold off for 7 days. That we may send messengers to all of the territory of Israel. And then, if there is no one to save us, we will come out to you. Well, it seems that Israel had re-inhabited this particular area known as Jabesh-Gilead, and the Ammonites are not very happy that they're back in the territory. They're not really strong enough yet to fight, because that's what sin does to you. Sin takes all the strength out of you. We start allowing something in our life and it weakens us. And if we continue to allow it in our life, pretty soon we just learn to live with it and we quit fighting it. Well, Israel had a knack for stepping away from the Lord. That represents the sin. It is a sin to step away from the Lord. So they were not strong enough to be able to fight this Ammonite tribe that was coming against them. So they ask for a covenant of peace in exchange for a life of servitude. In other words, if you will make a covenant with us and you won't kill us, we will become your indentured servants for the rest of our life. Now, you got to be pretty desperate to make a covenant like that, don't you? But if you have no other choice, if you have no other resources, you have no other way to combat this, you're really left without very many choices at all. It sounds fairly good to Nahash, but that's not enough. He wants the right eye of every single man that is there. Now, keep in mind that at this particular time, being left-handed was an extreme exception. How many left-handers do we have in here tonight? Okay, probably 1%. It's still an exception to be a left-hander. But even more so at this particular time. Soldiers fought with their right hand, and they held their shields with their left hand. That shield, as it was being held up with the left hand, guarded most of their body and their face and their left eye. They would peek out from the side of the shield, and most of the vision, most of the contact, most of what they were doing would come from the right eye. So if you take out a man's right eye, you render him absolutely useless for combat. So he's saying, yeah, we will make this covenant of peace and you become our indentured servants, but we want to make absolutely sure that you never rise up against us if we do this, that this is not just a temporary thing. So we will spare you. We will not come in and kill you if you will give us your right eyes. Not to mention that they make it clear that this will be a permanent mark of that slavery and a slap in the face of all of Israel. And look at their response. Well, give us 7 days to get some help. Now, you know, that strikes us as a little odd, doesn't it? But there are rules of engagement. It used to blow me away when I was younger and my brothers were in Vietnam and there would become a holiday and they would call a peace treaty for 2 or 3 days. You know, we're not going to fight for a couple days because it's a holiday. And after the holiday, we're going to kill each other again. You know, I never quite understood that, but there are rules of engagement that people abide by. So he says, give us 7 days to get help. If we can't, we will do exactly as you have asked us to do. In other words, if we can't get help, not only will we become your indentured servants, but you can have our right eyes. Now, you got to be pretty desperate for this, don't you? But they didn't feel they had any choice. What a heavy price to pay for peace. Look at verse 4. So the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul, and they told the news in the hearing of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices, and they wept. Verse 5. Now there was Saul, coming behind the herd from the field. And Saul said, "What troubles the people that they weep?" And they told him the words of the men of Jabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard this news, and his anger was greatly aroused. So he took a yoke of oxen, and he cut them in pieces, and he sent them throughout all of the territory of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying, "Whoever does not go out with Saul and Samuel to battle, so it shall be done to his oxen." And the fear of the Lord fell upon the people, and they came out with one consent. When he numbered them in Bezek, the children of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah were 30,000 men. Now, did you notice that the king of Israel is still ranching? He's still a rancher. He's a reluctant king for sure. He's still carrying on his farming and ranching duties. It says there in verse 5, now there was Saul coming behind the herd from the field. He had not stepped into his kingly role yet. How many of us might still be ranching when God's calling us to a kingly role? Ranching is noble, is it not? It's an honest-to-goodness way to make a living. It's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. The only thing that makes it even somehow wrong is when God's called us to do something else. It may not be ranching. It may be candlestick making. I don't know. It could be any job that we're doing or any role that we're doing when God has said, "I got something else for you. I got something else that I want you to do." But I want you to notice that even though he is ranching, because he has been chosen, and because the Lord had called him and given him that new heart, he could not sit still and see his people suffer. Who knows? Maybe Saul was the kind of guy that could hear them weeping before and it didn't bother him. But now all of a sudden, he can't do that. When he hears his people weeping, something inside of him stirs him up. And see, that's one of the ways you know that God's beginning to work in your heart and call you to another deeper walk with him, is because certain things begin to trigger inside of you that were never there before. Maybe you start loving God's people in a way you never loved them before. Maybe you start loving the children in the children's ministry in a way you never thought before. Maybe for the first time in your entire life you consider going to the mission field. And that's never been in your mind or ever in your heart before. And all of a sudden, God begins to do something in your heart. And you begin to react to those opportunities. Saul hears the crying and he can't live with it. He can't just sit there and do nothing. So he takes a yoke of oxen and he cuts them into pieces. Now, the yoke of oxen doesn't mean the yoke of the oxen. It means the oxen, right? He takes the oxen, he cuts them into pieces, and he tells the messengers to go and tell all of Israel that if they do not rise up together for this war, that the same thing will happen to all of their oxen. Now, you might not think that's a big deal, living in Phoenix and driving cars and having tractors if you're a farmer. But in this culture, in this agricultural society, it was a big deal. It was their horsepower. You know what I mean? It translated into more crops. It translated in the ability to plant better, to plant more. It translated into harvest. It translated into money. It translated into feeding their families. And so this was a big deal for them. Now, I want you to notice he also throws Samuel's name around a little bit. You ever been around people who throw around names? Kind of name droppers, and they throw. It kind of, whether it's right or wrong, the reason it's done is to give a little credibility to the individual, to make them appear to be important. Well, Saul's not important yet, right? He's not really standing on his own as king yet. So he may give this order and people go, who are you? You're the Saul that we don't like. You know, you're the one that's going to be king in spite of the fact that God really doesn't want a king. You know, we're not going to go do this thing. But he throws Samuel in there, and Samuel is established. Remember, Samuel's words went out, and they did something. They never fell. They accomplished what they were meant to accomplish. Everybody knew who Samuel was. They had watched him since he was a little boy, and they watched the anointing and the power in his life. They saw that God was with him and that God followed up what he said. So when he put Samuel in there, they might have thought, well, I don't know if Saul can pull this off, but I know that Samuel can. So look at what happened. 330,000 men show up to this war. 330,000 men who were not going to show up before this. Oh, I don't know, maybe there was a few hundred people in the other village, you know, subtract a little bit. But still, you've got 330 men who were not going to do this, and now all of a sudden, they are ready to do battle. Now, I can't help but notice a few things in these first eight verses. But the way I'm going to point them out to you is I'm going to ask you some questions. And I'd like you to think about the answers to these questions. Here's number one. Why did the people have to be threatened before they responded the way God wanted them to? Why didn't they, when they found out that their brothers were in trouble and they needed help, why didn't they just respond and say, you know what, there's help needed, these are my brothers, I'm going to drop what I'm going to do, and I'm going to get involved in this war, and I'm going to be a part of this. Why did they have to be threatened? And you know, you might say, well, threatened is a pretty strong word, but I don't think so in this context, do you? If you don't do it, I'm going to kill all your oxen. That's a threat, isn't it? It's about as close as you can get to a threat, I think. So I want you to think about that first question. Why did they have to be threatened before they responded the way God wanted them to? Here's the second question. Why did it take such a strong slap in the face to get their attention? Number three. What would you think if someone today, a pastor, an elder, a deacon, an evangelist, a radio or TV preacher, or anyone else that you know in Christendom, what would you think if they used this kind of method to motivate people? Fourth, I'll ask you the last question here. Do you think Saul was in the will of God for doing this? Or out of the will of God for doing this? And now I'm going to do my best to try to answer those questions. First one, why did the people have to be threatened before they responded as the Lord wanted them to? And why did it take such a strong slap in the face to get their attention? Here's the answer. Sin and self are a very powerful combination. Sin and self is a very, very powerful combination. Where's my evidence? I'll take you to Mark chapter 14, verse 33. Mark chapter 14, verse 33. Now, please keep in mind, guys, we're going to be talking about one of the major events that changed the world. We're going to be talking about a very, very emotional time, a very, very pivotal time for mankind, for all of Christianity here. This is an important event, an important time, probably one of the most important. And I want you to look at Mark 14, verse 33. He, meaning Jesus, he took Peter, James, and John with him, and he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. And then he said to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death. But stay here and watch. And he went a little further, and he fell on the ground, and he prayed that if it was possible that the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Daddy, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me, but nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. Jesus is getting ready to face his toughest hour. He's going to the cross for my sins, for your sins. He takes along three of his closest friends to be a part of this, to be his backbone, if you will, to be his strength, if you will, to stand in prayer for him as he goes in and agonizes and sweats great drops of blood as he goes to his Father to prepare himself for what's next. Tremendous honor, wouldn't you think, to be amongst these three, to be asked to go and stand for the Creator of the world, the Savior of the world, the Creator of the universe, to be able to stand with him in this difficult hour, to be his prayer partner during this time? 37. And then he came and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, Simon, are you sleeping? Now, Jesus knows the difference between sleeping and not sleeping, right? That's kind of not what he's asking. You know what the question is? Simon, how can you sleep during this time? Simon, do you not understand the importance of this? Simon, do you not understand what I'm facing? Simon, do you not understand what I ask you to do? Simon, do you not get it? Simon, do you not understand that the fate of the universe stands in this next hour? Do you not understand that all of Christianity is right here and you get to be a part of it? You can come out as a soldier. You can come out standing and you're sleeping. Could you not watch for 1 hour? Is the weight of this not important enough, Peter, that you could stay awake for an hour, that you could dedicate yourself for one single hour? 38. Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation, for the spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Guys, I believe that we as Christians, we face this same thing all the time. Our spirit is willing. We love the Lord, don't we? We would like to believe that we would be there for him. We would like to believe that, Lord, I'll go anywhere you want me to go. I'll do whatever you want me to do. Lord, if you're calling me in deeper, I'll step in deeper. If you're calling, Lord, I'll do it. And maybe from the spiritual side, we really mean that. We really mean that. But are we really any different when God requires an hour from us? It's too far. I'm too tired. I can't talk. I can't walk. I can't sleep. It's going to rain. It's too cold. You know, we got a million of them. And we're not alone. It's been going on since Moses, and it'll probably go on till he comes back. But can we give up an hour? Is it because we're mean, horrible, evil people? No. But it is because sin and self is a terribly powerful combination. 39, again, he went away and he prayed and he spoke the same words. And when he returned, now they got it. Now they're up, now they're alert, they got a prayer vigil going on, they've called other people in for the prayer meeting because they know how important this is. And after all, Jesus has scolded them a bit, you know? Couldn't you stay awake for an hour? So now they got it, right? When he returned, he found them asleep again. For their eyes were heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. You ever been at a place where your eyes are so heavy you can't keep them open? That Sunday afternoon thing that happens after you eat lunch. And you know, they're starting to roll into the back of your head. And you, people are talking to you. Porch light's on, but nobody's home. You hear them talking. You hear them talking, and you're just fading. Just fading out. And you can. And it feels so good. You're just fading off into the sunset. And at that time, the house could probably be on fire and you wouldn't care. The spirit is willing, but the flesh wants a nap. Couldn't you stay awake for 1 hour? They didn't know what to answer him. What do you say? You're caught once, you can say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean, you know, I just fell asleep, I didn't mean to." Comes back the second time you're asleep, what can you say? They didn't know what to say to him because there really wasn't anything to say. All you can do at that point in time is just claim your sinful self. That's all you can really do because there really is no other excuse. And then he came a third time and he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? It is enough." You know what that means? Time's passed. You had an opportunity to stand with me, but you didn't. You had an opportunity to be involved in something that was going to change the world, but you missed the opportunity. Now, did he throw them out of the kingdom? Was he mad at them? Did he not love them? None of those things. He still loved them. He still forgave them. They just missed a tremendous opportunity. How cool would it be to be able to say, "I was there in the garden with Jesus when he went to the Father and he was facing his most agonizing hour, and I stood with him." But that's one thing they won't be able to say. They can't say that. I wonder how many times I've fallen asleep when God wanted me awake. How many times I fell asleep when God wanted me to be involved in something life-changing. How many times could I not give up an hour or not give up an hour and a half? And really, at the end of it all, I really didn't get any spiritual blessing. But if I would have given that hour, I would have been blessed. See, it's not about feeling guilty. God doesn't want us to feel guilty. He wants us to see the opportunity. He wants us to see that it's you can sleep when you're dead, right? Yeah, you'll have the rest of your life to sleep. Yeah, figure that one out. But we won't always have the opportunity to be involved in the things of God. Tonight alone, I've had a chance to be involved in things of God by praying with people, by sharing with people, by sharing God's love and God's mercy. And you know what? If I was home, you know what I'd be doing? You guys all be calling me for one thing, but you know what I'd be doing if I was home? I'd be watching TV, most likely. Again, I don't want to lay a guilt trip on because I could do that, right? I could do that without God being mad at me. But when it was all done and I shut my eyes and I went to sleep, what would I have gained? More junk, right? Because there's not too much redeeming value in it. But I'm richer tonight because of you. I'm richer because of getting to pray, because of getting to share the things of God. So, he comes a third time to him and he says, "Are you sleeping again? You still sleeping? Well, that's enough. The hour has come." In other words, the time to be involved in this, the time to pray for this, it's gone. How many opportunities have I missed? See, here's the point I want to make. If God's calling you to this new thing, just do it. Just say, "Lord, I don't know how, I don't know what. Give me a new heart, give me the ability, give me the desire, but let me do it. Let me step through the door. Let me do whatever this thing is, because this hour is going to pass and somebody else is going to get the opportunity to do it. And all that's going to happen is I'm just going to miss it. I'm just going to miss the opportunity to be able to do this. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." The disciples were just simply too busy doing their own thing. The thing that they wanted to do was sleep. They were tired, their eyes were heavy, their eyes were rolling in the back of their head. They succumbed to their own thing, their own agenda. They wanted to do what they wanted to do. So here's the answer to the first question. Why did these 330 men not respond? They were too busy doing their own thing. To be worried about the other tribe in the north that were going to get attacked and have to have the right eye put out. Well, I'm really sorry to hear they're going to lose the right eye, but I'm busy tonight, you know? I got other things going on. And that's what happens to us. We get so engaged in our own lives and our own things and raising our own kids and our own self-pity and our own jobs and our own tiredness that when somebody else needs us, there's nothing left. Or we think there's nothing left. And we think, well, you know, it's not really my problem. You know, I mean, I don't want him to get hurt, but it's not really my problem. But you know what, guys? Scripture says we're all a family. It says when one of us hurts, the other one hurts. All of the resources and all of the human resources and all of the numbers were already there. They were in place to defeat these guys, but they just needed to care. Right? Isn't that all that changed? They just needed to care. Here's the next question. Was Saul in the will of God or out of the will of God for using such a method to motivate people? Well, look at verse 6. I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt. Look at verse 6. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul. He did this in the Spirit of God. When he cut the oxen and he sent it all out and he says, look, you guys, this is going to happen to you if you don't step up and do this. Now, we can back that up because we know the children of Israel, that Joshua told them to drive out all of the inhabitants of the land. Right? We already know that. We know that was already God's will, and they had not taken care of these people. So they need to back up and they need to go drive these people out. Guys, I think as New Testament Christians, we need to be careful to not lose our backbone. Now, what do I mean by that? I think sometimes as New Testament Christians, we just are so spoiled and we're so bathed in the grace and the mercy of God that we just don't really care. We can say, God bless you, be warmed and filled, and I hope everything works out really well while we're swimming in the grace of God. Doing our own thing and minding our own business. And I think we take a look at Saul and we take a look at this harsh method and we're going, as New Testament Christians, we're going, well, gosh, where's his grace? Where's his mercy? Well, grace and mercy hadn't motivated these people, right? God's deliverance from Egypt hadn't motivated the people. Slavery hadn't motivated the people. Having the right eye put out of thousands of their friends didn't motivate the people. Sometimes, as I said before, we can miss the will of God because it doesn't fit our mold. I would bet you that if God had used Saul to do this for us now, most of us would get up and walk out. We would go, too harsh, no grace, no mercy. Not giving me a choice. God wouldn't do that. I'm not going to go help. Can't possibly be God's will. Guys, we need to remember that even as New Testament Christians, we are supposed to have a backbone. Jesus cleared the temple. Now, please do not use this as a license to go out shooting people and bombing abortion clinics, because that's ridiculous. But that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that Jesus cleared the temple. He had a backbone. When there was something that was wrong, he stood up and he took care of it. He called Peter, one of his best friends, Satan. Called him Satan. Sometimes we need to have a backbone. Now, it's important to keep in mind that Jesus was very non-aggressive when it came to defending himself. Jesus was very non-aggressive when it came to defending himself, but he got downright physical when it came to clearing the temple. And he got downright aggressive when he called Peter Satan. So when people are coming up against us, the pattern that we have for Jesus is to be calm and be kind and be gentle. But when people stand against the word and they stand against righteousness and they stand against the truth, we have to have a backbone. We have to stand up. And I believe that sometimes we're going to have to be exhorted also. Now, look at the results of Saul's methods. You've already seen that. 330 stood up. I'm going to read through this last section kind of quickly for the sake of time, but look at verse 9. And they said to the messengers who came, "Thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow by the time the sun is hot, you shall have help." Then the messengers came and reported it to the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Therefore the men of Jabesh said, "Tomorrow we will come out to you, that you may do to us whatever seems good to you." So it was on the next day that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp in the morning watch, and they killed Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it happened that those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. Then the people said to Samuel, "Who is he who said Saul reign over us? Bring these men that we may put them to death." Isn't it funny? They didn't do anything about these men, but now all of a sudden he's victorious in battle and they want to come in and puff up his ego a little bit more. But Saul said, "Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished salvation in Israel." Then Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there." So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they made sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. So they were victorious. The 330 men came together. They went to battle. They did what they were supposed to do, and they were victorious. So here's what I want to say, guys, and that is we have to care. We're supposed to care. We're supposed to care for each other. We're a church family. And when one of us is hurting, we need to be there for each other. And I want to say this too. If you're a Christian and you've been a Christian more than 5 or 6 years, you probably don't come to church for yourself. You come to church for everybody else. In other words, what I'm saying is that if you're 5 or 6 years old in the Lord, you've probably heard most of the sermons. You're not going to probably hear anything new from me. You probably have a devotional life, and you're being fed on your own in the Lord. So you're really not coming necessarily to hear from what God is going to do necessarily through me. If you get that, that's just an added blessing. But please keep this in mind. The reason that you come is for the person sitting next to you, and the person sitting behind you, and the person sitting in front of you. Because you are ambassadors of God's love. And you just never know when He's going to use you in an incredible way in their life if you'll just open your heart and care. And they may share something with you, and you may go home like I used to after counseling and going, "God, I don't know what to do. I can't do anything." But you never know. God just might open a door for you to be a blessing in their life. So remember that when you and I choose to stay home, and please understand, I'm not doing this as a guilt thing. Please know my heart on this. But when you and I choose to stay home, we rob somebody else. I know that sounds funny, but we really do rob someone else of maybe an opportunity to pray for them or to hug them. And you know what? Along the way, you just might get blessed. That other person that's there for you that night, they may be the one that comes and sits next to you and says, "Man, you look a little heavy-hearted. Is there anything I can do?" And you know, sometimes when we least expect it, God just kind of sideswipes us. You know, when we're just sure we've heard this before and we're not going to get anything out of this, something happens and God just does something in your heart and touches you in a miraculous sort of way. Well, they got set free. They didn't have to go into slavery. They didn't have to lose their right eye. But their freedom was not free. Did you notice they fought from sunup to about noon? And when you have a war, you know what happens? People die. So some of these people who were sitting and not caring, some of them lost their lives. So for some, it cost absolutely everything. But freedom is like that. Some folks pay the ultimate price for the freedom of other people. Our soldiers do that right now. They go fight a war that's not popular. Vietnam was the same way. The soldiers came home, people spat on them because it was not a popular war, and they didn't care about them being there. They got caught up in the whole political side of it and didn't see it. It's kind of the same thing that's happening now. But we have men and women who are willing to pay the ultimate price so that you and I can have freedom. Freedom is not free. But guys, if men and women are not willing to pay that price, freedom will cease to exist. If you and I are not willing to go to war for each other, freedom ceases to exist. If we're not willing to stand with each other, we will see our brothers and sisters fall. We will see them in slavery. We will see them with not just a right eye poked out, but a left eye poked out and their whole life messed up. God has given us such a tremendous opportunity to not fall asleep, but to pray, to be there for each other. So may we always be willing to throw our hat in the ring. May we always be willing to say, hey, if there's a brother and sister in trouble, you can count on me. I'll be there. And lastly, did you notice that Saul could have had the heads of those who didn't like him, those who had spoken evil of him? But he did not take that opportunity. So on one side, you see Saul actively aggressive, and on the other side, you see him amazingly gracious. May God give us the ability to know how and when to apply which one in each other's life. Let us be a little more aggressive in the defense of the gospel and a lot more loving towards each other.